Hello and welcome to Let's Talk Relationships with clinical psychologist Trish Purnell-Webb and mental health accredited social worker John Flanagan, a podcast for therapists and couples interested in understanding real relationships. So today, John Flanagan and I are here in Seattle at the Master Trainers Retreat for the Gottman Institute. It's a wonderful event that occurs every year where all the Master Trainers come together to discuss various things with regard to Gottman Therapy and the Institute, including new research, new training programs, new thinking about how to help couples. And we're very fortunate and blessed today to have Dr. Bob Navarra with us. And Dr. Bob's been with the Gottman Institute for quite some time now, and he works very much in the area of the relational space around drug and alcohol recovery. Welcome, Bob. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the Gottman Institute, what drew you there, and the work that you do?
Sure. Hello, Trish and John.
Well, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Yes. So my entrance into the Gottman, the land of Gottman, goes back to 2005. And at the time, I've been working in the addiction field and had developed a theory of couple recovery and was presenting at various places, conferences and lunches and so on. And what happened is that one of my colleagues who's with us this weekend, Linda Voorhees, had heard my presentation and felt that there was a lot of overlap with my approach to working with couples in recovery with the Gottman frame, and had encouraged me to attend a level one training, which is the introductory level, of course, to Gottman training. And John was doing the solo presentations at that point, and this was in San Francisco. And I joined some 450 therapists at Cathedral Hotel in San Francisco and heard John speak, and I got hooked immediately and saw that there were immediate overlaps and parallels in many instances between this model I had developed on working with couples in long-term recovery with the Gottman frame. What was exciting to me is that I had the theory of couple development, but I didn't really have the interventions to help facilitate movement through some of the stages that I had identified. Mm-hmm. And so when I learned some of those stages in that level one training, I kind of got addicted, so to speak, as they say, right, on this model. And so I, of course, progressed just like in rapid fashion through all the level trainings. Mm-hmm. And then Linda had invited me actually to present. At the time, they were doing certification workshops, for people in certification track. Mm-hmm. And so these were like Gottman seminars, workshops, and I was invited to co-present with Linda. Mm-hmm. So we did. Mm-hmm. And then over the next several years, I became a certified Gottman therapist. That goes back to 2007. Mm-hmm. And had presented many times, actually, at the Gottman conferences at that point. Mm-hmm. Caught John's eye and ear, and he said, let's collaborate. And so they were writing opportunities, and so we collaborated in some chapters and really facilitated this workshop, which originally started with a workshop for couples in recovery from addiction, which is my first workshop. Then my second workshop I created was couple addiction recovery training, that one day training for therapists. Mm-hmm. So long story long.
it's fascinating how these things come together.
Absolutely. And just drawing the parallels with your original work and John Gottman, Julie Gottman's model of relationship, what a wonderful marriage.
Absolutely. Well, the models, they just work so well together.
Yeah.
You know, and it was really, Etana was really sort of the linchpin for me in all of this. So she's the one that encouraged me to develop these workshops to begin with. Mm. And I had never written a manual, and I'd done many workshops, but never in such a formalized, accountable way, you know, to include a manual that was very detailed. And so that's what happened. And that was really sort of the launching of what I believe is sort of a new age in recovery, because the model that, I'm bumping into that I'm wanting to change is this notion that we need to separate partners when they get into recovery and establish their individual recovery before doing any couples work. Mm-hmm. It turns out there's no empirical evidence to support that.
And they're suggesting like 12 months of that, of individual work before you bring a couple. And what's your thinking about that, Bob?
My thinking is that that's harmful to couples. What we've learned is, to some couples, if not most really, you know, what we've learned is that one of the biggest predictors of recovery stability is a stable relationship. That is the single biggest predictor. And we also know that couples impacted by substances have divorce rates considered somewhere between 4 and 7 times higher than the general public in the US here. So it's like we're not doing enough early intervention to help stabilize a relationship impacted by addiction and now impacted by recovery. There's a whole concept of the basically the trauma of recovery, which is overlooked. Understandably, because we think, oh, good, you're finally in recovery, so now things could get better quickly.
So that's sort of white-knuckle recovery.
White-knuckle recovery, well, it's actually more than that. In that, the treatment emphasis tends to isolate the relationship out of recovery, says each partner needs to work on their own individual recovery, and we postpone that year or more until we get to the recovery for the couple. That's the part that I'm challenging, you know, and so they may have individual support and recovery, but not relationship support. And that's the thing that's different about the model I'm proposing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems really important to me because in that year of recovery for an individual, the very nature of recovery is that they change a lot about the way they view themselves, the way they view others, the way they view their environment. You know, it's sort of along that trauma recovery stuff as well.
Yeah.
And so it seems like that would create all sorts of new dynamics in a relationship that would be really difficult to navigate without some assistance.
That's exactly what I'm thinking and have experienced. And I have been working in addictions for quite a while now. It goes back to 1987, actually. And so I was trained in this other model. I was clinical director of a drug and alcohol treatment program. And that was sort of the assumed progression that you get individual before you do any couple stuff. What happened is I was working with couples in my individual practice, identify addiction, and in many cases were able to sort of facilitate entrance into recovery. And then it made no sense to me to stop the couple's work.
Yeah.
And so to continue with the couple's work and to help the couple stabilize this recovery process into their relationship just felt like a natural flow.
So how early is early in terms of couple recovery work?
That is a great question. We don't really know. Mm-hmm. I don't have really the research to support, you know, what happens at different stages for couples. The way it's sort of lined out now is that typically the first year of recovery is really difficult and painful for just almost every couple, right? So early recovery means you're entering into recovery that first year. And that's when I think, even right from the get-go, it's appropriate to introduce couples work, adjusting the goals. So we're not looking for deep interpersonal relationship development. What we're looking at is stabilizing a relationship that's been destabilized by addiction, now destabilized by recovery. And there are some very specific strategies and interventions that can really help integrate recovery sooner than later, which will hopefully impact this divorce rate that's so high, disproportionately high.
Absolutely. Because I imagine, you know, when you're the partner of someone recovering, you're waiting for a relapse. And so the initial joy of recovery can be overtaken by that sort of waiting and that the anxiety and the stress about, is my partner going to relapse again? Are we going to revert back?
That's spot on. That's exactly right. And what, unfortunately, sort of the strategies now are to, well, your partner has to work, your partner's recovery, you have to work yours. So talk to a sponsor or some other support person or a therapist. And what I'm thinking is that one of the cardinal features of an addictive disorder is the inability within a system, within a couple or family scenario, to talk about what's happening. And we recreate what I think could be traumatic, again, re-traumatizing the couple to say, we don't want you to talk to your partner about your concerns or the things that you need, you know. She needs to work that out themselves with themselves, and you work on your stuff. So the model I work from is encouraging and supporting each person's individual work. So this is not to the exclusion of their individual support and recovery, on the one hand. On the other hand, what I'm finding is that introducing couples work allows them to at least have the opportunity to support one another and to understand what's needed to stabilize the relationship. And so we have a minimum of three recoveries I'm addressing concurrently, mm-hmm. each individual partners and the relationship recovery, and they do not need to be mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. That's the part mm-hmm. that I think is kind of a newsflash for a lot of folks. Yeah. Mm.
So in terms of that, those kinds of conversations and the Gottman model itself, mm-hmm. Is there sort of like stages they go through? Are there particular interventions that work better at different times through their recovery? How does that all yeah. kind of knit together?
This is what was confusing to me after my dissertation was on couples and long-term recovery process, basically developmental process. What I found and sort of uncovered in my qualitative research is that there were three components. But like the Gottman model, they're nonlinear. It's not like you do one before you do another. So it's not a stage theory in the sense of that model. It's an interactive thing. So what came out of the research, my research, is an integration of this nonlinear model with, we need to talk about how to stabilize the relationship so that recovery is a part of what's identified as a relationship issue, mm-hmm. instead of only an individual mm-hmm. issue. And then another component is integrating and addressing family of origin issues to the degree that they're influencing people's ability to stay sober or to stay in recovery or mm-hmm. the impact it has on the relationship. Mm-hmm. All of that mushes together. Mm-hmm. And then the third is more about boundaries of how to do self-care and how to do relationship care. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the three components that I have formal names for and mm-hmm. interventions. I have a two-day workshop for couples that address each of these components and provide strategies in a blueprint to be able to talk about recovery and the relationship issues in a brand new way.
Mm-hmm. So that's a workshop for couples in recovery from addiction?
It is. Yes, it's called A Roadmap for the Journey. Mm-hmm. And so it's really exciting to do this. I've done this workshop now maybe in, I think, four or five different treatment programs. Mm-hmm. And it's been very well received, mm-hmm. I have to say. One of the programs was a Rainbow Treatment Center in eastern Arizona, mm-hmm. which provides services to the White Mountain Apache tribe. So I was actually invited to wow. provide this workshop. Mm-hmm. It was a three-day workshop. It was spread out over 3 days mm-hmm. for these couples in recovery. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering about the cultural piece, and it worked out really, really well, mm-hmm. well received. So they've done that 3 years in a row now, mm. you know, so there's that.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So, Bob, I know, you know, our listeners are going to be asking themselves, when are you coming to Australia to run programs like that?
I would love to answer that question. it's a mission. You know, I was able to provide some training to Korean therapists.
Yeah,
right. South Korean therapists. And it was sort of this notion of there's a international need mm-hmm. for bringing strategies to couples mm-hmm. of how to manage the impact of these things. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's also interesting to me is that I've been able to even translate some of these interventions and strategies with couples impacted by anything that's major physiologically or mental health-wise. So the same strategies can be easily adapted to talk about bipolar disorder if somebody mm-hmm. has that diagnosis okay. or cancer. Mm-hmm. It's this notion of, we need to talk about the thing that's in the room with us that's yes. impacting us mm-hmm. without blame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because my master's thesis was looking at the effectiveness of couples therapy with couples where the one partner had a diagnosable bipolar.
Oh, that is interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and the it was a one-off study, but mm-hmm. The outcomes were amazing. And the key factor in the outcome was the ability of the couple to talk about the problem, which was the bipolar symptoms mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. and to talk about what they each needed those symptoms were being enacted, and that the more they understood each other, the better they communicated. So when the partner with bipolar was experiencing a bit of hypomania, their partner would be able to point that out in a very gentle way, uh-huh. and together they would discuss strategies to help them out. And the same if they were becoming depressed, and that was the deciding factor on which couples benefited.
Wow.
And which didn't. So
real attunement.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. This is exactly the model. You know, you have a relational approach to dealing with these significant major mental health or physical issues, rather than the sort of the stereotypical individual treatment only and excluding the relationship. That needs to be sort of the holding environment for the reality of this pervasiveness and the, you know, the potential trauma, really. Mm.
Yeah. And I imagine, though, with addiction recovery, you would also have to build in with the couple what they would do when, you know, when somebody uses again.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about relapse strategies and discuss what happens if, and what are the strategies, and what needs to happen, and what are the limits. Mm-hmm. And so that's also built into it. I mean, if you think about it for a moment, it's like, well, all right, so we've got these partners that are now in recovery of some kind, or at least the partner with the substance issue or the behavioral compulsion, in recovery for something, right? It's like, well, how does this couple operate and deal with all of the uncertainty of not knowing about relapse? Mm-hmm. And do we have alcohol in our house for this next holiday thing that's happening? And what do we tell our friends? And there's so many questions that have to be sorted through. And without guidance or structure, these couples are really struggling, you know, especially, particularly when they're told not to talk about these things, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah. So in our practices, we see, you know, some problem use of, you know, alcohol or drugs, you know, maybe even like a substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. And then we see addiction, you know. Can you talk us through your thinking about those three levels, how you see it?
Yes. And this is actually borne out by research as well. Uh-huh. So so these are statistics from the U.S. I suspect that they translate into other cultures or relatively closely to other places. But it turns out that 90% of the people who binge drink actually do not, in the U.S., do not meet the qualifications for alcohol use disorder. Mm-hmm. They're mismanaging alcohol use, which is problematic in itself. We know there's something like 200 diseases associated with misuse of alcohol. We're not talking about addiction. We're talking about the physical consequences of alcohol. So there's that. Most people with a substance issue are not addicted. Most people who use heroin are not addicted. But there may be problematic behaviors that have to be addressed. And so the therapist or the health professional needs to begin to assess where on this continuum a problem use is this person. So we've got problem use, and then we have criteria as defined by the DSM-5. Are you not ICD?
No.
Okay. So different classification of diseases, right? So the DSM-5, as we know, is a mental health way to understand mental health issues, right? Diagnosis and so on. So there's 11 symptoms associated with an addictive disorder or a substance use disorder, I should say. And if you meet two of those symptoms, then you qualify for a substance use disorder mild.
Yeah.
Right. Hit four, we're up to moderate, and then six, severe. Mm. Right. So what's interesting is that there's statistics that look at 70% of people diagnosed with alcohol use disorder will not meet that criteria in 4 years.
Right.
What that tells me is that there's a behavioral mismanagement of alcohol that has not shifted into the disease of alcoholism, which is characterized as fundamental shifts and changes in the brain, which is really well documented in the literature. So is addiction a disease? Yes. Is a substance use disorder a disease? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And that's the distinction between problematic use, a use disorder that might go away even without treatment, but at the severe end, it's not likely to remediate much.
Yeah.
You know, that's the problem. Mm.
Without treatment, you mean?
Without treatment, right. Exactly, yeah. And, you know, in the States, only 10% of people who need substance treatment get it.
Right.
Yeah, only 10%.
Okay. Yeah. And I think I read somewhere, maybe you said it at something, that once somebody has had an addiction, that true recovery doesn't really occur until 6 years of sobriety. Is it something like that?
No, but I know what you're referring to, I believe.
Yeah.
So there's different points of recovery, right? So the first year of recovery, The first year, there's a high relapse rate. So if somebody's committed to recovery, that first year, more people relapse than stay sober. Mm-hmm. Once you get on the other side of that 1 year, statistically, then more people stay sober than relapse. It's like 60%, 60 plus percent.
Yeah.
When you get to 3 years, and 5 years especially, 5 years is considered the durable point of recovery. Mm-hmm. I think maybe this is what you're referring to. Yeah. So it doesn't mean that it's not real recovery. It means it's a stable point of recovery mm-hmm. in which less than 15% of people who've reached five continuous years relapse.
Right.
Less than 15%. Right. So your so what we're learning is that somebody who has it also hit that mark at 3 years, but that 5 years is really considered, I think, more reliable.
Right.
And you go, somebody hits that 5 years of recovery, that durable point of recovery, they're probably going to stay sober.
Right. Mm. Well, I think, isn't it the statistic that they have as much chance of becoming addicted as somebody who's never had an addiction?
That's right.
Is that what it is?
That's right. Yeah. That's how it works.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's an interesting number, that 5 year. Point
isn't
seems
it?
To be,
you know, that 5 year point reflects some pretty significant remission characteristics for cancer, right? It's sort of a parallel.
So if you had just say three tips for couples with some sort of substance use issue going on, what would they be?
All right. Well, it depends where things fall on the continuum.
So
a lot of couples, of course, I work with, and a lot of the questions I get from therapists are, what if there's evidence of a substance issue? What do couples do? Mm. And so it turns out I'm actually writing an article on this very issue. Like, I just finished it, and I'm sending it in tonight, as it turns out. And it's important to name the concerns. Mm-hmm. So as we know in Gottman training, the so-called gentle start is to say, here's what I'm seeing, here's how I feel about what I'm seeing, and here's what I'm hoping for. Mm-hmm. That's one way to put it, right? Mm-hmm. So I notice that alcohol is impacting our relationship, or opioids or whatever, fill in the blank. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned about that. I might be feeling scared. Mm-hmm. And those are the feelings associated with this behavior. I would really appreciate if we could, you know, have somebody figure this out with us or evaluate if that's needed. Mm-hmm. Or would you be willing to try to alter your use? Mm-hmm. So if somebody's mismanaging a substance, it doesn't mean they're addicted. Mm-hmm. So they may be willing to change their current use. If they are addicted, then that change probably won't be too long lasting. Mm-hmm. Unless more is added. I mean, I'm not trying to say absolutes.
Yeah.
So it all depends on the severity of the issue, what the next steps might be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tip number one is raise it with a gentle startup.
That's right.
To start the conversation and see what's possible.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Tip number two would be to get education about the nature of an addictive disorder or the nature of substance use. Mm-hmm. And so there's no shortage of websites that can provide that. Of course, you want to make sure you get a legitimate one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so the National Institute for Drug Abuse, NIDA, I can't remember the acronym for, it doesn't match their website.
Right.
But if you Google National Institute for Drug Abuse, that's a really good informational spot to land. And the other place is the NIAAA, which is the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse and Addiction.
Right.
That does match. Mm-hmm. It's call letters, so to speak. Right. And that would be another great place to get information just online.
Mm-hmm. And tip number three?
Tip number three would be to maybe get individual support for yourself to see if you have a partner that's not willing to either pursue that or make changes, is to then find the support that will help you sort of manage.
Yeah.
Or let's say you're the one struggling with the issue of the substance and your partner doesn't want to be involved, then I think pursuing individual evaluation assessment would be good. And frankly, it's a bit hard here in the States to find therapists that have that level of understanding.
Yeah.
My ideal for couples in this situation would be that there actually be a couples therapist that could help sort of sort this through. So there's familiarity with addiction and relationship issues and it all could be sort of managed, you know.
Yeah.
So tip number three is the hardest, I think, and that's to see if you can find support that will help you figure things out.
And if you had three tips for therapists who maybe have some Gottman, but, you know, because in Australia we only have 16 now certified Gottman therapists, but we've got hundreds who are in training. So if you're a Gottman therapist in training and a couple with addiction problems comes in, what's your top tips for them?
You go to the workshop that's coming to Australia soon called the Couple Addiction
Recovery. That's a great tip, Bob.
Oh, did I tell you I have one of those workshops? A one-day training. The option to that would be, my workshop was filmed by the Gottman Institute last year in Berkeley. And so there's an online class of that.
I've watched it. It's excellent.
Okay.
Yes.
There's that. And the other is, I would really encourage your listeners, your therapist listeners, or any listeners to go online and get information on the audit. AUDIT. Yeah. So you're sounding familiar with that.
I think we're Australians developed it, to be honest.
That may be the case.
From the World Health Organization, but it was that, Australia.
Right.
Yay.
Yes, I am very proud of you all. Exactly. Then, as you know, it's got cultural sensitivity, it's been in many different languages. Yeah. And what it does, it's a screen that helps therapists figure out with their couples or their individuals where they fall in this continuum of low risk to high risk to dependent. And so it's very useful. The audit manual is free, non-proprietary. You can access it. It's 40 plus pages. And there's several other websites that I teach my students. I teach addiction treatment at Santa Clara University. I can send you the links of supporting manuals and PDFs that are free that provide therapists with them. Really good background of how to administer this thing. You do not need to be a specialist in addiction treatment to give this.
Okay. That's fantastic tips for everyone and really good information. And thank you so much for the work that you do and the research that you've done. It's really brilliant to be able to inform our therapeutic communities on how to manage these things. We're also going to put on our website, and we'll talk a little bit now about some of the Australian resources that are available as well for our therapists and couples. But I actually think it's time we headed off to dinner. So
Alrighty.
Thank you so much for talking with
us for the
today,
invite.
Bob. It was really lovely.
Bob, it's been fantastic. The knowledge and wisdom you bring to this field is spectacular. Thank you very much
for the opportunity to share some of what I think I know.
And we're going to try and catch you again sometime soon for another conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Alrighty.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you for listening. Our special guest today was Dr. Bob Navarro, a senior certified Gottman therapist, master trainer and consultant for the Gottman Institute. For more information about Gottman therapist programs and couples workshops here in Australia, please go to our website relationshipinstitute.com.au.